Hello, welcome to Relevant Tones. I'll be your host for this episode, Matthew Dosland, and today I am delighted to be joined by the composer Rain Worthington. Rain, how are you?
I'm doing great, and this is so nice. I'm excited to be talking with you. I love conversations about music.
Me too, and our listeners do as well, so hopefully I think there's going to be a lot to talk about this episode. I first ran into your music when I was in graduate school. I was looking for a solo piece to perform on a women's concert was the idea, all women composers. And I found the New York Women's Composers website, was just kind of going through everybody's profiles, and I ran into yours. The thing that kind of initially grabbed me was kind of, I think it's in the first couple sentences, self-taught composer. What led to you becoming a self-taught composer and one that's in this world full of people who typically, let's say, are not self-taught? How did that kind of end up happening?
My career was self-directed. I started, I've spoken about this quite a number of times. For many years, I didn't tell people I was self-taught, because I thought that would work against me. And, I was up against a lot of high level people that had a lot of high level training. And it was very intimidating. And so I just kept that part quiet and just wrote pieces and sent them out and stuff like that and did the best I could. So I came to music through the piano. And I was staying at a friend's house, and they had a grand piano. And I ended up spending a lot of time in the house on my own. And I just sat down and started plunking around on the grand piano. And I just fell in love with the sound of the piano. The thing about the piano that made it an entry point for me was that it's accessible, unlike the cello or the violin or a lot of other, most every other instrument, except maybe percussion and harp, you can hit a note and you get a great sound without any technical skill, So that made it possible for me just to go into the music. So that's what happened. I just started experimenting with the sounds and making up little pieces and memorizing them. And so I had a little collection of pieces that I worked on, short pieces. And I had been living in Boston at the time, and then I moved to New York. And I brought my piano with me. I had this great old upright piano that I got at an antique store. And when I got it, I went in and I said, "Do all the keys work and the pedals, do they work?" And he said, "Yes." And it looked beautiful. And so he said, "Sit down and try it." And I said, I don't play, but I just, if it all works, I'd like to take it. I'd like to buy it, And so I did, and I brought it to New York with me. And of course, like when people saw it, they'd say, "Who's the musician?" And I'd say this basically the same thing. I'm not a musician. I just make up things. Now, the other part of how this worked with my career is when I moved to New York, it was mid 70s. There was this whole minimalist movement happening at that time. A lot of it was happening in New York, but it wasn't only the minimalist movement in music. What was happening was an integration of the arts and an openness between the arts. So poets were going to art exhibitions. Dancers were coming to composers' concerts. Visual artists were, it was just this whole crossing of media, and people in the arts supporting each other. And so often a lot of concerts downtown New York, as opposed to more uptown kind of classical, formal, very structured music. A lot of performances were in loft spaces around the Soho Tribeca area of New York. And when the lofts were empty and artists were moving in. And so the first concerts I did, I happened to meet a composer named Charlemagne Palestine. He had a Burzendorfer piano at his loft. And I had seen many of his concerts at his loft, which were phenomenal experiences. So I asked if I could play some of my music for him. He said yes, and he said he gave me the keys to his loft so I could practice on the piano and do concerts there, schedule some concerts there. So those were my first concerts. And I played from memory. I didn't know how to write music. So I played the pieces from memory. They weren't improvised. It was just a set of pieces. Then I was like on my way.
Yeah, that's so cool. And that time frame in New York is something that, I think, if you're interested in contemporary American music, you hear a lot about that kind of confluence of the artists, the musicians, the poets, all kind of intermingling and creating these different things and these different works and these different ways of looking at music and their own media and in other forms, and kind of a beautifully rich artistic environment that there was a lot of sharing, a lot of collaboration. As you kind of made your way through that as a composer, how did you start to then develop from just kind of plunking things on the piano and figuring out, okay, these are the sounds I like. What was it like during that time, and then kind of moving out of a little bit of that kind of really heavily artistic collaborative world as it kind of moved into the 80s and the 90s a little bit? But how did you start to find more of your own sound? How did you start to kind of set yourself apart in a way, or?
Well, I kind of had my own sound because that just was what was happening musically, because the way music is like it's just so connected to the translation of my emotions, my life experiences, not life experiences programmatically or anything, but just the emotional channeling of life just kind of comes through me into music. That's just where I go with it. And so that's why going to the piano and having it be so accessible, what made it so easy to do that. I just started hearing the sounds and just getting absorbed by the sounds. So from Charlemagne's, I did a couple of concerts at Charlemagne's loft and a concert at another loft. And then I went to the kitchen, which was a big performance space at that time. And I took one of the tapes from Charlemagne's concert to the kitchen as my audition kind of thing and was given a concert there. At that time, I think Rhys Chatham was the director there. Eric Bogosian was the sound person. And so I did a concert there, but I had tremendous stage fright as a solo performer, I did this concert at the kitchen, but I was so nervous in the beginning. I thought, I'm just gonna have to stop. I can't stop my knee from shaking. I can't stop my hands from shaking. I don't know what to do, but I continued through it, and then the music took over, and I managed to go through it. But because it was stage fright was a real factor for me, I decided that I wanted to start playing music with other musicians. And so I went electric. And so I got an electric keyboard, a synthesizer, and started playing. It was a Casio synthesizer, and it had like a rhythm thing, that you could start up. And so I would make up pieces using that. And then I got together with some musicians, people would recommend people. And so I formed a band, and my first band was called Zone. And I have to say, the musicians were great and very patient with me because I was the director. I came in with the footprint of the piece, but it also had the Casio rhythm section going. And so I played it with the rhythm section going, so they had to hear, had to play with that going. But it worked, and so we were together for like a couple of years, like 2 or 3 years, and we played all over New York, CBGBs and Tin Pan Alley and Roulette and all the places that were around the downtown new music scene and all the venues. And that band broke up just because some members wanted to go more commercial and add as at one point we added a singer. So it was just and I wanted to go more kind of avant or artsy or stick with that. And so then that band broke up and I'm still in touch with a lot of those guys. And then I formed another band that was definitely more artsy. It had a vocalist who did not who did vocalizations, not words, and could sound like anything from a Chinese opera to a street junkie. And she was just great. She was a natural performer, a really exciting, dynamic performer. And her name was Jill Burton. And then I had two percussionists, a Japanese woman and a guy from Israel. Kumi played e-drums and Yuval played a regular drum set. And so that was the band, me on my minimal keyboards without the rhythm section.
Okay, we've set
Yeah,
that
I
aside
moved
now.
on to
Okay.
another synthesizer. And so Jill doing vocals and the two percussionists, with their sensibilities mixing in. And again, we played all over the place, again, CBs and Roulette and Tin Pan Alley and Danceteria and Peppermint Lounge and, all these different places. So, but to continue the story for a second, that band broke up. Bands do break up after after a while. Oh, and at one point we added a cellist to that band. I decided I wanted to become, quote, a legit composer. And so I didn't enroll as a student. I enrolled as a non-matriculating student at Hunter College. And I took 1 year of theory, ear training, and beginning piano. And I nearly failed all of them.
A relatable story for many a music student, I
I
think.
mean, I couldn't read music, so I had to learn to read music. Music was always relative to me. When I was doing it on the piano, a lot of times I was playing with my eyes closed. And later, when I went back to try to write some of the pieces out, I was so surprised that a note was the same, like going up in a passage and coming back down. I was so surprised that I was hitting the same note because to me it sounded so different. It just the approach just changes the feeling. And since most of it is based on feeling for me, it was just really interesting. So intervals, forget it. I just couldn't hear them. And sight reading piano, yeah, your expression says it all.
Yeah, difficult at the best of times.
Yeah.
And I am by no means a keyboard player of any kind, but I passed. I passed like you, I passed the class in college, but let's not go into how by how much.
Yeah, I just barely passed, so it was so what
Oh,
it's like.
absolutely.
And here I have been playing piano, but I couldn't read. So anyway, that was kind of how I got into actually starting to compose for other instruments.
How did you going from kind of small band, these, drums, vocals, that kind of thing. You learn a little bit of theory, you learn some of these orchestration techniques and such. What was it like to write for something that you knew would be an orchestra? How did that come up? How did that process go? Because that's a pretty big step in my mind, going from a few maybe lightly written out parts and then, taking input from a very collaborative process to trying to put sheet music in front of however many musicians.
I took the same kind of journey in a way of following musical lines. So I wasn't thinking vertically, I wasn't thinking harmonically. So I would start with a line on some instrument or an idea or something. And sometimes, most of the time, I would plunk it out on the keyboard at first, a line or an idea, like it could be a motif. I'd start with that and then just kind of start playing with where should I put this? Where should I have it mirrored or not mirrored, echoed in another instrument or something? It was kind of like that. And I just fell, like I fell in love with piano. I fell in love with the idea of the sound of an orchestra. I love writing for orchestra. It's just the colors you can get, the power of the sound, the complexity, and it's really neat. And I love adding in like vibraphone or the tam tam. I just love the whole thing.
There's so much available in an orchestra. You know, there's so many sounds available to you, and I can see that's you certainly use a lot of the sounds, and you use a lot of the timbral qualities of the orchestra. And maybe now's a good time to talk about Passages Through Time, which has some orchestral work on it, and has this gorgeously lush orchestral music on it. And I believe that's your most recent recording.
Yeah, that's my most recent. It's the second solo album I've done. The first one was Dream Vapors.
With kind of your most recent recording, I know I'm skipping probably 20 years here. Just I'm interested in the most in your last recording venture. How did it get made? I mean, how it's your only your second solo album. It's all your music. That's a daunting task, I think. You've done other albums where your pieces have been featured and such on many recordings. What's it like to put together that album, and how did it start?
Well, when I started writing orchestra music, it's very hard, as you must know, it's very hard for contemporary works to be programmed on orchestra programs.
Yes.
And so I decided I had two early works premiered by the orchestra of the SEM Ensemble with Peter Kocik conducting. And so those were the first times I heard my orchestra music played. They played a piece called Still Motion, and then they played Yet Still Night. Hearing those, it was part of a composer's workshop that he held, and hearing those performed, I knew the works were, the writing was working for orchestra, but I also knew it was very, very hard. I was very lucky to be accepted into those two composer workshop performances, concerts. And so I decided that what I needed to do was document my orchestra music through recordings. And so the first recordings I did were through EMR Media, and they did Yet Still Night, and they did Shredding Glass. I was lucky to get good recordings of those. And of course, it's like putting together a photography book for folk photographers. A lot of photography books are partially subsidized by the photographers. Same with orchestra recordings. The composer ends up subsidizing the recording a lot of times. I would say quite a lot of, quite the majority of times. And so, so from ERM Media, I then went to Parma Recordings because it was just, I just really wanted not to lose my orchestra work. I wanted to have it documented. And so I went to Parma Recordings and started doing recordings with them, and they were great to work with, just great. And they involved the composer in every step, the recording process, the editing of the tracks, the packaging, and everything. So I did one piece at a time over many years, as I could afford it. And when I had enough pieces to do the first album, Dream Vapors, then I there was like one more piece to add, so I would have a full album of works. And so I had that last recording session and then put the album together as part of that package of recording the last piece and then putting it together. And the same was true with Passages Through Time. Dream Vapors, I think, was released in 2016. And so Passages Through Time was 2022. Six years. It takes me 6 years, to get this together. And for Passages Through Time, I included some chamber works, which I hadn't done. The first album is all orchestral works, and the second album includes a couple of chamber works.
Is there a little more agency for you involved in picking chamber musicians to work with on the albums?
Oh, the chamber pieces on the album were Audrey Wright is a violinist who's now with the New York Philharmonic, and she just does an exquisite job with that. And the cello piece is Resolves. That was Carmine Miranda. He's an incredible cellist, a master cellist. He's at Belmont University now. And I went to Carmine because I had gotten a request to write a, not a commission, but just a request from someone to write a cello piece. And I had never written a solo cello piece. So I wrote that. And I didn't know whether it worked, whether it was playable or anything. So I had met Carmine at a recording session in the Czech Republic because he was doing an album through Parma of concertos. And so I asked him, I said, "Hey, Carmine, can you take a look at this and see if it's playable?" And he said, "Yes, it's playable. And not only is it playable, but I'd like to do a little demo recording for you." And so he did this demo recording in his home studio, and it's just beautiful. And so when I was putting together this album, I asked him his permission to put it on the album. So that's how that happened.
You've written, I think, quite a bit for strings and kind of solo and chamber ensembles with strings. Is there something in particular that attracts you to that sound world of the, string family, or?
Yeah, I am attracted to just, I guess my emotionality kind of fits into string sound a little more, but just a little more easily. And it may also just be that I'm able to print out fingerboards from the computer and get a sense of it. So I have like a whole thing of fingerboards that are on paper, and for the cello piece, I actually printed out a fingerboard and put it on cardboard, and kind of just sat there and tried to figure out, what's possible. But then at one point, I rented a cello because I love the sound of cello, and it just yeah it well it's my. If I sung, I would sing lower. So, it kind of fits more in my vocal range, I think. So I rented a cello, just started playing around with it. It was kind of amazing to get my hands on the instrument and see, realize, I mean, discover that things that look impossible on this staff are actually doable when you cross strings. Oh my God, you can go from this high note to this low string, this low note, just crossing strings, and it's like that on the score, but it's not hard. So I had a lot of fun just doing stuff like that, like crossing the strings and doing double stops and things like that, till I started getting calluses on my fingers. And then I said, "Wait a minute, I'm not really going to become a cellist. So I think I need to go back to writing at this point, But I loved the experience of having hands on. I think for me, it would be a little harder for clarinet and things like oboe to be able to play around with it as much, to get that." Develop the breath and the embouchure or whatever. Well, I guess embouchure is for brass, but the breath for the reeds and getting a sense of the fingering is different,
Yeah, and it's I think that it's hard to become really good at a stringed instrument as it is hard to become really good at any instrument, but there is a certain aspect of you can at least make sound and you can kind of touch it. There's a physicality to it, whereas with a wind instrument, I've never been successful at making a wind instrument sound at all. Brass, woodwind, none of it. So I can definitely, I definitely sympathize in the sense that there's no real, like, how do you emulate the French horn? Like, there's so much just in the embouchure, like how that has to be done. And yeah, I can see.
Yeah, it's such a beautiful. I mean, all of them are such beautiful instruments, but if they can sound awful if you don't know what you're doing, and it's really hard to get to that point of like even beginning to know what to do, without taking in any lessons or so. I love bassoon too. I love the bassoon, which is kind of like the similar range to a cello in a way, and so I like those low instruments a lot. But yeah, that's it's just simply a practical kind of thing on my part.
Yeah, and practicality is, it's not a bad thing. With what's coming up for you, I want to get a sense for what you're working on now, where you're going, what you're interested in, what's grabbing your attention right now. What is coming up? What are some new works maybe that you're writing, premiering?
Well, I had a premiere in a West Coast premiere of Shredding Glass in June, and that was great. And I got a nice review from the San Francisco Classical Voice. And I had a very collaborative experience with the assistant conductor, Kyle Baldwin, who conducted the piece for the concert at the Redwood Symphony. You know, that was great because we ended up talking about the piece Shredding Glass a lot and what it meant to me personally to write the piece because it came out of 9/11 and I had a connection to that. And so that was a really nice I didn't go to California for the premiere. I just couldn't go, but doing the video and talking to Kyle and getting the review was just wonderful. And then I have a piece that was commissioned by the Palisades Virtuosi, who are a trio, flute, clarinet, and piano. No strings.
Oh.
And so I did a piece for them. I wrote a piece for them, and it was, you know, it was really cool because it was a challenge for me not to say, "Hey, can you bring in a cellist and stuff?" Or a violinist. So that's going to be premiered in November. And then I'm really excited because I'm going to submit a proposal to present a talk at the International Conductors Guild conference in January in New York City. I connected with them for an interest in through the IAWM connection. For my advocacy for the IAWM, and I saw that they had a group of women, they have a women conductors group. So I was reaching out to them, and I had started having this great exchange with Jan Wilson, who's the exec director. She said, "Well, just thinking out loud, how about, you know, I'm thinking that it might be cool to have you do a talk at the conference." You know, so I have to submit the proposal, which I'm working on now, and it has to get accepted. But it comes at a really cool time because I'm thinking a lot about the state of the world, and I'm finding it a challenge. It's been challenging as it has been, I'm sure, for anybody, for everybody on the planet, but also for people involved in the arts to kind of hold on to the belief that what they're doing is worthwhile in the face of everything. So I've been thinking a lot about that, and I started reading the book Awe, which is a new book that's been released, and it's called the Awe, AWE, The Science of Everyday Wonder. And there's more to the title, but how it's and it's trans and how you can transform your life or something like that, you know. But it's basically the science of awe, the emotion of awe, and how it is a response to the vast mysteries of life in the world, you know, and how different things inspire it. And he goes into music quite a bit, and he goes into the science of how it travel, how music enters your body through physicality, your auditory senses, and for musicians through your body movements and stuff like that. But for the listener, just through the ears and how the path through the brain that it travels and stuff. And because they can map some of this out, the neurophysical aspects of listening to music, they've discovered that people who listen collectively to the same music, like in a concert setting, their bodies start synchronizing. Their breathing, their heartbeat, their brain activity starts synchronizing as a collective group. And so it's you become one, your experience is becoming one with those around you. And there are other aspects of awe, like It stimulates, it kind of engenders acts of generosity and things like that. So it opens you up to different ways of thinking and different ways of acting and, seeing other perspectives and stuff like that. So it's been a great book. It's been really re-energizing my belief, reinvigorating my belief in, the arts. So the thing I want to write about for the conference is how to enhance the concert experience to allow that to happen. And to we have a lot of competing things going on in the world in terms of performing arts. So, how to bring the concert, the orchestra concert experience into that kind of field while preserving the experience of music as opposed to making it an orchestra concert while you're watching a movie. I mean, people are trying different things, but what I want is to preserve the potency and the experiential awe of live concert music. And how do you do that without subverting the music,
Yeah.
kind of thing? So I'm really excited about doing that. I have a lot of ideas that are like kind of out of the box. And
Good.
and so I'll be curious to see if the proposal gets accepted and also what the conductors who are at the conference say about these ideas, because a lot of it's some of the things are being done, but not all of them, and not always successfully,
Right.
And how do you bring what part does AI play in it and stuff like that, but I just think that concert experience, there's so much disengagement in the world. Technology is creating so much disengagement. People are isolated, looking at their screens, looking at their computers, and spending time on their computers. Even virtual reality disengages.
Yeah.
There's a lot of disengagement in the world, and what I want to do is preserve the kind of enhance the environment for to create intentional listening.
Yeah.
Because the other thing that's happening is listening has become cheapened because it's background for everything. It's just you it's kind of evolving so that people disengage from listening, instead of listening more intentionally. It's just always it's so pervasive. Music is so pervasive, all kinds of music. Whether you're in the grocery store or the ba public bathroom or,
Yeah.
the train station, whatever, you have music around you all the time and it's background, So how do you preserve the idea of intentional listening in concert settings?
Thank you. thank you for talking, and thank you for being here and jumping around throughout your whole life and life story and all kinds of things and chatting about everything. So,
Yeah,
yeah.
thank you for your openness to go explore different tangents and rabbit holes, and it was really nice. Really
That's
nice.
what makes it fun.
Yeah.
We explore whatever we can. And well, I'm really excited to see what you do in the future. Everything you've done so far, I've enjoyed, so I'm looking forward to things. And yeah, if you those listening, I think it's rainworthington.com. You can find media, you can find recordings, you can find list of pieces, you can get scores from there, I think.
Yep.
Go there, find Rain's music, please. It's wonderful. It's a joy to perform. Thank you again, and yeah, have a good rest of your day. Bye bye. Relevant Tones is a production of Access Contemporary Music, a nonprofit organization with the mission of bringing musical creativity to life every day. Find out more at acmusic.org. We also have a Patreon that you can contribute to at two different levels, $5 or $10, if you enjoy what you're listening to. Find out more at patreon.com/relevanttones.